former News of the World editor says the continuing row over phone hacking at the newspaper is distracting him from his current job. The PM says he's sorry to see him go.
He did a very good job as Director of Communications, both for the government and for the country. He ran the Downing Street press office in a very professional and straightforward and correct way, and I think has done some very good work. But I understand why he wants to go.
Police have until late tomorrow evening to keep questioning a man arrested on suspicion of murdering Joanna Yates. Vincent Tabak, a neighbour of the 25-year-old architect, was detained yesterday morning. Specialist teams are searching the Dutch national's flat in Bristol. Tony Blair's been heckled at the Iraq war inquiry. The former Prime Minister was recalled a year after first giving evidence. As the session closed, he said he wanted to make clear that although he doesn't regret taking Britain to war, he does have some regrets. His comments were met with cries of too late.
Of course, I regret deeply and profoundly the loss of life. I just wanted to say that because I think it is right to say it and it's what I feel. Thank you. Now, if I...
Quiet, please.
Alan Johnson's ex-bodyguard is facing an investigation over allegations he had an affair with the former Shadow Chancellor's wife. Mr. Johnson quit Labour's front bench last night because of personal reasons. It's been announced that British Airways cabin crew have voted in favour of fresh strikes. Members of Unite were ballotted following a long-running dispute over pay. The union will have to give 7 days' notice of any action. And it's been confirmed George Clooney has recovered from the malaria he contracted earlier this month during a visit to Sudan. His spokesman says it was the actor's second bout of the disease. He was visiting the country to monitor the elections there. That's the latest. I'm Rachel King.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Are you a woman or know a woman who's made a difference in our community? The Women Who Make a Difference Awards 2011 are in recognition of the valuable contributions women are making to improving and sustaining our community. It could be any woman who's inspired you, been a role model, or made a difference in your life. The awards ceremony will be part of the International Women's Day celebrations in Bristol. For more information and an application form, contact Fiona Watson on 922 2329 or email fiona.watson@bristol.gov.uk. All nominations must be received by Monday the 7th of February. These awards are run by Bristol City Council and the Bristol Women's Forum. Women Who Make a Difference Awards 2011. Women Who Make a Difference Awards 2011. Promoting women's equality.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to Friday Drive Time, BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Health and Inequalities and Ashley Ward Councillor in the City, John Rogers. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as ever, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we take a look at the murky world of the European Union. Do our MEPs have any power? And why is there so little discussion about the rights and wrongs of the EU? We talk to one of the UK's most vehement Eurosceptics. And Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth is here to explain the latest big business threat to our environment, drilling for shale gas. That's in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of minus 2, a little frosty but dry. This weekend, highs of 5 degrees Celsius, fairly cloudy but dry with some outbreaks of sunshine. Next week, highs of 5 Celsius, a fairly dry week with some sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 29th and 30th of January, highs of 6 Celsius. Not exactly making it up to the warm temperatures, is it? But fairly dry next weekend with some sunny spells too. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Health and Inequalities and Ashley Ward Councillor, John Rogers. Hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, you're a medical doctor, are you, as well as a councillor?
I am. I've been a GP in the city for 30 years now. I trained in Bristol University, came here in 1973, and I've been in... stayed and loved the city ever since.
Now, you're a councillor for Ashley Ward, which is at St Paul's and around there. Is that where your surgery is?
No, my surgery is down in Avonmouth. I used to be a GP for 20 years up in Southmead, so I was a GP there. Then I went into industry and worked in a computer company in Birmingham, and then I came back and worked as a single-handed GP down in Avonmouth.
So. Now, how do you juggle making all the big decisions about what goes on in Bristol with actually being a GP too? There must be a lot of pressure on your time.
Well, when I got elected to the council, I cut down to from 5 days a week down to 3 days a week and do 2 days plus weekends and nights doing the council work.
Weekends and nights as well?
Yeah, yeah. It's an old habit that dies hard. You know, as a GP, we used to go out at night. We don't anymore, so it's good. But I just enjoy having a portfolio of careers, really. And when I became elected to the cabinet, when I joined the cabinet, I cut down still further, and now I really only do a day and a half a week in general practice.
So can you tell us how the cabinet works? Do you meet down the pub? Do you have meets in the evenings? How often are you actually chatting to each other just as a cabinet?
We just have the eight of us meet every Thursday morning. So we usually get in at about 8:30 in the morning and spend a couple of hours together, 2.5 hours together. We go through all the issues. So, for example, yesterday morning we had our meeting, we all raised the issues we wanted to, and we had over 30 issues which we felt we needed to discuss to look at the different areas of what the council is doing and what impact it has across the city.
Now, there's a lot of criticism of the cabinet system, saying that really it's much better to have a proper discussion, fuller discussion of the full council.
Indeed, and I mean, I think there is quite a debate, and part of the changes that the new government's bringing in is a suggestion that we can have a choice about that. The cabinet and scrutiny system came in about 2000, and there is talk now of perhaps saying, well, let's go back to a sort of more committee-based system where all councillors are involved in all decisions rather than just a selected few. There are pros and cons in that. There's also people saying we should just have one person making the decisions in an elected mayor, and let's have, you know, so that, you know, having one person making the decision, having eight people making the decisions, or having 70 people making decisions, each have their benefits, but frankly at the moment I think the eight people making the decisions in Bristol are making good decisions, and we're trying very hard to be decisive and clear on what we're doing.
Now, one of the decisions which has probably been most controversial, maybe for several years, is the decision to sell off some of Bristol's parkland and also bits of open space. Are you sure that you've got that right? Because there seems to have been quite a backlash after the decision, and also lots and lots of people saying, well, they simply haven't listened.
Yeah, well, it's certainly been one of the most politically difficult topics. It's the Parks and Green Space Strategy has been going for about 5 years now, with cross-party support. All councillors have given support to that process, and the idea is to make sure that every area of our city has good access to a range of parks of all sorts. Now, to make that happen, it was agreed that we would sell off some of the low-value green space, and we're not selling parks, we're selling some low-value green space.
But you're selling bits of parks, little corners of parks, strips along the edges and this sort of thing.
Yeah, and the idea there of selling an edge of a park is if you've got a park that's not overlooked, then if you put play equipment there, it just gets vandalised, whereas if you have some houses which are looking out over the children's play area, then it's not vandalised. So there's arguments for it. We've produced, the office has produced, having discussed with a lot of people, the suggestions of over 60 spaces that they felt were surplus to their requirements for parks. We consulted widely on that. We got, 15,000-16,000 responses on that, and we listened to every single one of those.
But surely most of those responses, John, were saying, no, we don't want this sold off.
What they were saying was that this particular park is special to us, or this particular green space is special to us, and why it was special. So we've listened to that. Certainly all the areas which had large numbers of people pointing out that it was special, like, for example, Wellington Hill playing fields there, which was, it's actually not the main Wellington Hill area, the Hawfield Park, but actually the area behind the houses, it's actually used widely by scouts and guides, and our officers weren't aware of that. So when that was brought to our attention by over 3,500 people signing a petition, we've listened and we've removed that. So at the end of the day, we've removed a number of those sites, which we hope will mean that people who are concerned about their areas will appreciate it, but it also means we can deliver £30 million of investment in parks and green spaces over the next 20 years. And frankly, I mean, the parks have had no investment for 20, 30, 40 years in Bristol. It's only recently that we've been able to get real investment, like, for example, some of the Playfinder projects. And we've got that because we were able to demonstrate we'll be able to look after our parks. And we have the money to do it through the Parks and Green Space Strategy.
And finally, the stadium is another big issue. Stephen Lansdowne banging his fist on the table saying, what are you doing? You're stopping the expansion of our city.
Well, I mean, the main issue there is about, there's two issues, I suppose. One is the Village Green application, which I know that there is discussions going on to try and get some conciliation in that area. And that's not the council doing that, that's the local residents in that area. And there's also the planning issues, and the planning process is a quasi-judicial process, which is not susceptible to political control. And in fact, that's really important, it isn't. So it is they're certainly tricky issues.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too. Martin, hi. And record-breaking year, apparently, we hear, for pawnbrokers. And also Tesco's are thinking of getting into the business. Why is that?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? In hard times, people have to pawn their stuff. And pawnbrokers do well. I mean, in recessions and depressions, certain kinds of industries tend to do well. You know, cheap supermarkets, pawnbrokers.
So we should be taking our shares out of, if we have all our big share portfolios, and putting them into people like the pawnbrokers and Tesco's.
Well, I mean, it's an ill wind that blows nobody to good. But of course, it's a sign of the times. It's a straw in the wind. I don't think there is going to be a recovery. I think there's quite likely going to be a crash this year. And then, of course, all bets are off for where we're going as a nation and in general.
There is a serious problem with pawnbroking, of course, though, as well, and that is that you're not going to get the proper, really, you're unlikely to get very high value for what you take down to a pawnbroker's as if you were to sell it on the open market. It's a kind of almost a measure of desperation.
Well, one of the measures of desperation is that lots of people, I can't remember, we covered this last week, I think, lots of people are paying their mortgages with their credit cards.
Yes, 2 million people in Britain are now paying their mortgages and their rents on credit cards.
Well, That is borrowing money from a credit card at 16% to pay your mortgage.
And more. In fact, credit card rates are going up at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that is another straw in the wind. The other thing I've been noticing this week is the Baltic Dry Index, which is basically measures going... It's a forward-looking measure of the cost of buying ships to move stuff from A to B, has actually collapsed,
which is
what happened before 2008 as well.
This is all bad news. So what would you do if you're in George Osborne's shoes?
Well, thankfully, I'm not in George Osborne's shoes. The question would be what I would do is if I was in Ed Balls' shoes. That's more...
Well, no, I mean, if you actually could determine policy on this right now.
Well, I think what we're going to find before the year is out is that the cuts policy that's being pursued by the coalition will fail, as it's failed in Ireland, Greece, Portugal and Spain.
So you would borrow money, would you?
No. You've got to fiscally consolidate, and we've got to have a robust discussion about who pays for the crisis. It can't be the people at the bottom. It must be the people at the top. We need structural adjustment for the wealthy minority in this society that have done well in the last 30 years. And as they themselves realise, when you're going to do a change like that, it's got to be shock and awe, shock therapy, like in Russia. And we're probably going to have to take about half the money off them. But we're not ready to talk about that yet. I don't think even Ed Balls is ready to talk about it yet. But by the end of the year, we will be.
Now, how are you going to get that money off them, Martin, when it's all squirreled away in secret Swiss bank accounts?
Well, we're going to come to that later, aren't we, about tax evasion. Most tax... Do you know most tax... what do you call them? Tax havens are actually British jurisdiction, whether it's Jersey or the Cayman Islands. Britain is in a unique position to close those tax havens down. The Germans are twisting our arm and saying, why don't you do it? And as the crisis develops, they will twist our arms even harder.
Okay, well, first story we're looking at this week is disaster looms for the NHS. At least that's according to the Morning Star we have this week. Six health unions have jointly signed a letter condemning the speed and scale of Health Secretary Andrew Lansley's NHS reforms announced this week, which they said risk putting cost before quality of patient care. Well, John, you're also a GP, and it looks like these changes by Mr. Lansley are going to be putting you in the driving seat. Are you happy about what he's doing?
I'm happy about what he's doing, not because I'm a GP, I'm actually a very much part-time GP, but actually the thrust of these reforms is to actually make much closer links between health and social care and actually improve the quality of people's lives. And by putting GPs in the driving seat, who GPs are really familiar with the problems that local communities have, working closely with elected councillors on the council and public health doctors and hospital consultants and voluntary sector organisations, having everybody working together to actually provide the best possible services for Bristol.
But does it surely make sense to have specialist managers to manage and then actually doctors to actually administer directly to patients the service that they need?
That's indeed exactly the issue. It's not going to be a case that every GP is suddenly going to be going off on management courses. There are probably going to be in Bristol 5 or 10 GPs who are already been elected by their colleagues to say, look, we'd like you to make sure that the services that we get from secondary care, the way in which we work with the council is as good as it can get. And they will be supported by plenty of managers, as they are now. So there's some big changes going on. I was at a meeting yesterday with chief executive of the council, chief executive of the NHS in Bristol, with I think 5 or 6 GPs and various people from the commissioning groups, all of whom talking about how we can make this work for the benefit of people in Bristol. And that, it was a very powerful meeting, and it started off with the question, what excites you about what's here? And the views around the room were unanimous. Even there were patient representatives there. Everybody there was saying actually they are excited by it. They have concerns, as the trade unions are pointing out, there are concerns in this process, but this is a very exciting possibility that actually Bristol can decide what sort of services we want to give to our patients, rather than having Whitehall dictating it, as they've done for the last, 50, 60 years.
Wasn't it a Liberal originally, Beveridge, that put this, the NHS and other parts of the social security system together after the Second World War? I think it was. And why do you feel as a Liberal that actually we need to turn that over?
It's not turning it over at all. It's building on what's already there. In fact, you know, people are saying these are radical reforms. They're not. There's actually nothing radical in any of it. The only radical thing possibly is saying we want social care and healthcare to work together. And that was actually what used to happen in the 1960s and 1970s. So nothing is new in what's being proposed. The only thing that's different is that saying we want to take away Whitehall control of what happens in Bristol. And that it'll be interesting to see. There are people who say if you do that, then you'll have postcode rationing, you'll have all sorts of, there are risks of problems with that. But if you really want to encourage people locally to take part in their services, develop their services, innovate in their services, then taking the dead hand of Whitehall out of this process is an absolute blessing.
Well, obviously, I'm not going to agree with that. The things that most worry me about this is that it's going to, by bringing in the private sector and the voluntary sector in the way that they are, we're opening British NHS to European competition law. European competition law will mean that you cannot decide, for example, to refer your patients to the local hospital because a private consortium may sue you through the EU courts to say that no, we're offering a better price than, and so you're not, in fact, you will then be forced through legal challenges to basically have a full market in services.
Well, what's the problem, Martin, services, with actually allowing private companies to bid to provide services?
No, because what happens is they can then say that you must take the lowest bid. That's what EU competition law says. And therefore, you might decide that you want to pay a little bit over the odds to a hospital that you want to work with because they're local hospitals and you've got a relationship with them. But you can be sued through the courts by people saying, we're offering a lower price, why didn't we get
it? Now, John, you're shaking your head
things.
There.
Well, two things. First of all, you don't have to take the lowest bid. It's not, that is actually not true. You have to take the most appropriate bid for your circumstances. You can phrase the situation in such a way that you can get the services that you need. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the cheapest. So that's the first thing.
Now, as budgets are pressed, though, of course, it's going to be a temptation, isn't there, to do that?
It will. But the second thing to point out is that Martin was talking about that we'll be forced to use private services. The Labour government forced us to have a percentage top sliced off our money in Bristol from central government, said you've got to use private services in Bristol even though you don't want to. They told us that we must do it, and we've got private health facilities that are underused, and we're being told, in fact we've just been told, that we can get people free taxis to take them to these underused private resources because actually we're paying money and nothing's happening. So I mean, it's a bit rich for others to say, oh, we'll get all overrun by the private sector. Bristol GPs are not keen on private medicine. They, you know, and that's been a long-standing thing. And we would like to see the best possible services. We want to see the best possible services locally from the likes of Southmead, Frenchay, the BRI and the Children's Hospital and so on. What we really want to do is to encourage really good quality local services for our patients.
Now, Martin, what's the problem with having health managers being able to decide, look, we think in this case, actually, it's a private contractor would be the best option?
Because ultimately, you then open yourself. The danger is that by stealth, we move away from having a national planned system. Let me make the case here for national planning. All this stuff about local devolution and all the rest of it. Most people, when they go to a hospital, do not want to be consulted about how the hospital is run or managed. They don't want to be involved in the running of it.
But they
want it to be there, and they want to know that it's of a certain standard.
Yes, but they might like
a national standard.
They might like to choose which hospital to go to.
No, this fantasy about choice in healthcare is simply wrong.
What you want
is the best quality for everybody without a fuss or a mess, and you don't want a league table of rubbish places where they do it badly and good places where they do it good. You want a standard for everybody, and that was the principle behind the NHS. But it wasn't just going to be a spatchcocked messy system, it was going to be a planned system, and it's a much more efficient system. British NHS is the most efficient. The OECD have said it's the most efficient way to organise healthcare. The amount of money we spend on healthcare compared to other countries is much lower because the NHS is the most efficient way to do it.
Well, might have been the case, but I mean, certainly now we're spending the same amount of money as European countries, and we get a much slower, less responsive service.
But
for our patients.
What about this? Martin. I'm going to ask John something specifically. Martin, can you just be quiet for a second, please? John, what about this argument there, though, that if it ain't broke, don't fix it? I mean, we've got a very good health service right now. We've got to be extremely careful. We're playing around with one of the most important institutions in the land.
We do have to be very careful with what we do, and it needs to be done in a very careful way locally. We have got a great team, both in terms of the Primary Care Trust, we've got a great team in terms of the doctors, we've got great local authorities locally, and all of those people are saying what we want to do is to be able to define the services without central control. And there's a difference. I mean, we totally agree that there's outcomes and that we should be setting good quality outcomes as part of the central things. What we don't need to be doing is having government tell us how we should do it.
Now, I've moved Martin Summers out of the way for a moment, and Marina Morris is with us, and she's got a piece, haven't you, Marina, on the NHS?
Yes, hello. In this week, the number of reported deaths from flu since last October has leapt from 112 to 254, 142 deaths in a week. Many GPs are out of vaccine, and last year vaccine stock has been issued out to alleviate shortfalls. GPs are being advised that their autonomy to order their own supplies of flu vaccine might be removed. This is a surprising message to send to the proposed future heavyweight healthcare commissioners. The two fundamental messages of the government NHS white paper published in July, equity and excellence, liberating the NHS, are clinicians need to lead commissioning and the system need to focus on patients' outcomes. The document represents a top-down reorganization of the kind explicitly ruled out in the coalition agreement document of the NHS. The plan is to remove a significant tier of management and some of its associated costs by abolishing both primary care trusts and strategic health authorities by 2013. The commissioning role of healthcare will go to general practice consortiums by 2012-13, who will assume full financial authority from April 2013. Responsibility for local health improvement will move to local authorities with a ringed budget. All providers, hospitals, mental health and children's trusts, ambulance services will go into foundation trust status in 2013-14. Foundation trusts are currently high-performing hospitals who own a semi-autonomous status and are not accountable to the health secretary, but directly to the parliament via their regulator. The NHS will no longer directly own providers, but simply fund healthcare. The regulator will become very powerful in the new system. The BMA, the professional body who represent doctors, say, plowing ahead with this change as they stand at such speed at a time of huge financial pressures and when NHS staff and experts have so many concern is a massive gamble. The legislation will allow competition to be forced on commissioners, even when they believe the best and most appropriate service can be provided by local hospitals. Commissioners should be free to choose the best and most appropriate providers, creating care pathway across hospital and community care boundaries without fear of legal challenge from private companies or the health regulator.
Thanks very much, Marina. Well, maybe the most important point there I'd like you to answer, John, is that even the BMA are talking about this as a massive gamble.
Well, I think the BMA will say that we're certainly enthusiastic about the potential of this, but now they're down to the situation of discussing the terms under which this is done. And you can almost guarantee that, therefore, now they'll be saying, oh, there are lots of concerns, because that's the way you negotiate a good settlement. And that's, BMA is a trade union just like any other trade union. It's a very honourable trade union. I'm a member of that honourable trade union. But however, it is a trade union nonetheless. And when you're seeking to get the best possible terms for your members, then one of the things you do is you say this is going to cause a lot of problems.
But they're also an independent force, aren't they, from the Department of Health, so that's another reason why the BMA should be listened to, surely.
Absolutely, and just as all the people that think, I mean, you've got Unite, Unison, BMA, Royal College of Nursing, Chartered Physiotherapists, all of those have very valid points, and all those points need to be addressed as part of the responses to the NHS bill. But all the evidence in Bristol that I've seen, and I've been involved in commissioning, GP commissioning, since 1990. This is going on for 20 years now. I was involved, I hated fund holding. I was absolutely fundamentally against the idea that there was going to be a two-tier system. And I and 11 practices around me, we introduced something called locality commissioning, which actually Labour embraced in 1997 big time. And we thought, you know, we're going to get a really good total purchasing projects and so on, which started then. But they all wimped out, basically, because what they wanted to do was to keep central control. So these sort of commissioning arrangements have been going on for 20 years in Bristol. We've got a lot of expertise, we've got a lot of careful, considerate, caring people who really want to see improved services, and this is a way to do it.
Well, what many people are saying is that the system of commissioning, where private companies can commission, or private companies are commissioned, would allow private companies to actually cherry pick some of the easiest to do roles of the NHS, a little bit like what's happened with the Royal Mail, where you've got private companies coming into the Royal Mail, taking away the easiest jobs, and meaning that actually ultimately the private companies are going to be making the money, and the NHS is going to end up denuded and may even be sold off eventually, like Royal Mail is now.
I think Martin hinted that he agreed with me about the fact that they shouldn't be using private companies top slicing money off the NHS budget, and that is certainly not our intention. GPs are very aware of these tricks and the ways that people do it. It is really important that we have a very transparent, open approach, not one which is just centrally driven and top down, where there's no accountability. The closest accountability to an elected person as a GP I had was the Secretary of State. That's the first elected person that actually has any control over me in the NHS. That is wrong. The new arrangements mean that there will be local councillors, there will be GPs responsible, but GPs, although they're not elected, they do at least have a foot in the community, they're known in the community, and they have a vested interest in actually doing the right thing for the community.
So we're not going to see in a couple of years the NHS limping along like the Post Office or the Royal Mail is now, and then we're saying, oh, well, we're going to have to abandon this now.
Not at all, no. I mean, this will improve it.
Martin? I give you the final word.
Well, obviously, I don't necessarily agree that this will improve it. I think what you've got to think about here is the politics of this. I mean, people voted Conservative, particularly in the election, because they wanted conservatism. In other words, they wanted David Cameron to run the country, but they didn't want him to overturn everything. They presumed that he was going to be a centrist and he was not going to overturn everything. I think when there are teething problems with this, and there will be teething problems, a lot of people are going to be very upset about it, and I think you're going to lose votes over it.
Well, moving on to a financial topic now, and in the face of the LibCon and Labour paralysis, in the face of massive banker bonuses, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to find out how you would fix the financial crisis and what you want to do with the bankers.
The Treasury wants to see new bank lending to business of £200 billion in 2011 to stimulate the economy. Should the government try to influence how much the banks lend?
I work for a bank. I think that they should have some influence, but they need to exercise great care in exercising that influence. What's for certain is that the present banking regime, hasn't worked. So therefore, I think some government intervention would be justified, but it needs to be very carefully thought through.
I think they should have some controls on how much the banks lend, yeah, during the next few years, because obviously they're not doing their bit for the economy. I'm not so sure about them interfering with their bonuses, though. I think that's more a case of they need to make structural changes in the banks so they have less money to splash around on bonuses anyway.
That's the big thing.
Maybe they should. We need investment in businesses, of course. I'm no politician, but, we're all hoping for something a little better, aren't we? Maybe they should be looking at lending more to help businesses along. That's what investment's all about, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think the bank should be independently run. So, no, I don't think they should have any government.
I think maybe the opposite, actually, because the government are in control of the country, so therefore if they're looking, they know how much, obviously, the UK is bringing in, so if they can help out the banks, then it would give them a good idea how much they lend out.
I'm from Spain, so now there the situation is so difficult, and I think the government should not be an influence for the banks, I think.
Should the government launch its own big society bank?
My reaction to that question is to ask a question, which is why would anybody feel that, you know, the banks, the government setting up a bank is necessary, particularly given that the government has virtually taken over some banks anyway. The government has such a big proprietary interest in so many of the banks, it doesn't seem sensible to set up a new one.
Yes, I think they should launch them not for personal customers, but for small business, so that small businesses have got a different source to go to for finance rather than be sort of held a ransom by the banks, which they are being at the moment, I think.
I don't know whether that's a good idea.
There's enough in charities and social work. I mean, there's enough money going to that now without putting any more in.
No. Because I don't think I truly trust the government, so I wouldn't trust them with money to lend out to just whoever they want.
Lend charities is a good cause, yeah, isn't it?
I know, so that sounds a bit mean.
So if it was for UK-based charities, yeah, then I would say, yeah, that would be, well, that's one part of it, and I'd say that was worth it.
I'm on the fence.
Now the governments are not really strong. They don't fight for the people, you know, they only fight for their own interest.
Would a government-controlled bank be open to abuse or undue political influence?
It's a good question, but I think if the necessary controls were put in place to prevent that happening with the requisite oversight by the regulatory authorities, then I think that risk should be either eliminated or certainly mitigated against.
If it was set up in the right way, no, I don't think so. There are forms of semi-public ownership where they have more or less independence from the government, I think. There is a model, Welsh Water, I think, is a semi-independent, publicly owned body, so it makes its own decisions, etc., and it has access to investment, I think. So no, not necessarily, no.
It's got every chance there, I think, hasn't it, John?
Yeah,
I think so.
Possibly, that's the thing. You don't know with these politicians who to really trust, so I'd... The way it goes at the moment, well, the way it is at the moment with a kind of coalition government, I think it's not particularly trustworthy. So I would say no.
Yeah, I agree.
That was Marina Morris out in the streets talking to you about what you think should be done with the banks right now. And it seems as there's several people saying that actually this idea of the government having banks which, rather than having to sort of go cap in hand to the city and say, please, will you lend, have their own banks that they can simply lend directly to businesses and possibly individuals too, Martin.
Yeah, well, there's a model for this which wasn't mentioned by any of the contributors, which is the Bank of North Dakota in the US, which was set up in the 1900s by populist politicians, you know, pro-farmer politicians. And the North Dakota has actually got the only solvent state in the US. They've got a budget surplus because they've got their own state-owned bank, but it's not owned by the central government, it's owned by the local government in North Dakota. Now, the problem for the private sector is well-run public sector banks like the Bank of North Dakota crowd out the private sector. Who wants to work with a private sector bank that's a rip-off when you've got a good, solid state-owned bank? And that's why there's a lot of opposition to the idea of state-owned banks by the privately run banks, because basically a well-run state system would outcompete the private system. The main point to realise is that the private banking system is bust. Their accounts are all fraudulent, Enron-style accounts. They're counting all of these CDOs and SIVs as if they're worth 100% of what they claim they're worth. They're not worth that. They're worth possibly nothing. And the banks are bust. We're living in a fantasy world. What's going to happen in the new year? There's going to be a general election in Ireland. I suspect that parties will come to power who will repudiate Ireland's debt.
You mean in a couple of months?
Yes.
We're in the new year.
Yes, that's what will happen. And when Ireland repudiates its debts, the City of London is exposed to the tune of $200 billion to the Irish debt. That will then crash the British banking system unless George Osborne comes up with another cheque from the British taxpayers. And that's just Ireland. You've then got Portugal, Spain. The British banking system is incredibly vulnerable because the British banks are owed money by all of these countries all over the world, and they're all going to default. The British taxpayer cannot possibly pick up the tab for all of this, so there's going to be a major crash, and it's not going to be clear what's going to happen, but there will be a crash.
John, why is it necessary this is what people are saying anyway, that they don't think that the government that you're here to represent, in a way, is actually using its power with Royal Bank of Scotland and other banks that it owns to actually get them to do what they're supposed to do. And people are now saying, look, we're fed up with this because the government aren't doing what we want. Why do people feel it might be necessary to actually set up another bank? I'd like to hear why the government is not forcing the banks that it supposedly owns to do what it wants.
Well, I'm not here to explain the actions of the current government. I'm a Liberal Democrat councillor in Bristol, and we have a majority in Bristol. We're not in coalition with anybody. So I don't know all the details on that. What I am aware of is that we have a banking system which mixes gambling with straightforward high street banks, the sort of thing that Martin is explaining about Dakota. They're not gamblers in North Dakota. What they're doing is they're saying, some people want to lend money, give money away, and they can do it safely through the North Dakota bank, and some people want to borrow it, and they can do it safely through the North Dakota bank. I don't know the details on that. But what we really want is to have high street banks, the old-fashioned high street banks, which were always run, if they didn't have the money to lend, they wouldn't lend it. But when they did have the money, they always made sure they had the money to do it. But what's happened over the last 10, 15 years is we've had gambling banks. We've had banks which have just said, oh, that's okay. Why don't we reuse that money? Let's use it again. Let's lend that money again to someone and again to someone. And we'll just keep doing that so that you end up with these huge debts. And unfortunately, you get banks which then is regarded to keep the economy going that they can't fail. So rather than regulating them, rather than stopping them doing those things, they were left to get on with it. People were allowed to pay off their mortgages with their credit cards. So the whole thing, money, loans, things. If people need to think about not using money they don't have. And if they do want to borrow money, then they need to be borrowing it very carefully. And
well, the first people to learn that lesson, surely, have got to be the banks, haven't they? The investment banks.
Well, the trouble is the banks are made up of shareholders who get lots of money from sort of having the trade that's going on. So, and it, obviously they ought to be paying out when things go wrong, but that hasn't happened. Also, bankers who particularly high-flying bankers, where they're getting huge bonuses on the basis that they're making trades and so on, and they're doing these sort of things. It just feels to me wrong that we've got a situation where we've got gambling banks that are the same organisations as high street banks, and Britain is potentially liable for any problems they do. And we've had to bail them out.
So when are the Liberal Democrats at Westminster going to do something about that? Because they're in a position to actually twist Mr Cameron and Osborne's arm.
Well, they're certainly, I mean, I know that there are a lot of discussions going on about the levy. I've been talking certainly privately about the ideas like the Tobin tax to actually get get money coming for every financial transaction. The difficulty is a lot of these things mean that if you were to go in hard, then the banks would then just up their sticks and go. And the whole of the city of London relies heavily on these sort of banking transfer and money going in, and so as does our economy. So there are some real challenges here, and I certainly don't pretend to have any of the answers to that. I'm just aware that as individuals here in Bristol, we should be thinking carefully before we borrow money, thinking carefully before we increase our debts. And if we're having trouble with finances, we should be approaching people who can give us good advice about debt, rather than just taking out a loan or getting a loan shark in or getting someone else. So people should be going, getting Citizens Advice Bureau. There is lots of debt advice. They can even phone people like Care Direct, who will direct them and signpost them to something that might be useful near to them. Because that's the way. If people don't have debt, then the banks aren't in business in this way. And at the moment, we have banks which don't lend to small businesses, that they basically just want to go for the risky, high-risk stuff, because they know that's where they can make loads of money, which is not in our interest.
So when are you going to go round them then and create the Bank of Bristol, Lib Dems, the great new Lib Dem policy?
It's an interesting one, that. We're obviously going to have to think about it. There is talk about a green bank and the way that we could perhaps use some of the environmental investment that's needed. We're looking at ways in which perhaps we can get the whole of Bristol insulated, for example. How do we, we've got houses which are cold, and if we're going to, why don't we start? And we're trying, energy's becoming more and more expensive, so why can't we? What about people, if people can afford to put some money in and other people can take it out? We've got feed-in tariffs and so on for electricity. There's lots of potential here, and we're certainly investigating. We're looking at European funding for these things. So there's lots of ideas that can be done, but I would encourage people to think for themselves about what their current own personal circumstances are.
But at a national and international level, Martin, where is this going, this struggle really between the people through the government and the private banks?
One of the problems is, in the US in particular, is that the bankers are the main financiers of the political process. So
isn't that the same here, though?
I'm afraid it is, yes. I mean, certainly for the Conservative.
Not for the Liberal Democrats.
No, you haven't got any money at all. It doesn't matter about you.
We borrow. Obviously,
I agree with what John's saying about mixing up casino banking and straightforward high street banking. It was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States in the Clinton era, which has opened the door to a lot of these problems. I mean, in actual fact, we used to have a pretty well-regulated banking system, both in the US and Britain, because of the experiences of the 30s. Lots of the things which have now come out of the woodwork were exactly the things that caused problems in the 20s and the 30s, which is why they were all made illegal. But what subsequently happened, of course, is all of these checks and balances have been chipped away bit by bit, and then we've ended up where we've ended up. Now, what I would like to stress, I mean, and the Labour front bench aren't stressing this because they're saying that the recovery is being threatened by what's happening. I think as an independent Labour supporting person, I want to get people to understand there is going to be no recovery, that we need a plan B. There is very likely going to be a banking crash sometime very soon. We just about escaped in 2008 the situation where the ATM switched off. We may go through a situation where the ATM switch off, and I think George Osborne, whoever's in charge, has got to have a plan B. And I think what my concern is that across the political parties we need to have a much more robust discussion about all of this. And I think that probably John and myself have got plenty of things in common, in the way we look at this. And so it's not a party political thing. If the right things can be done, I mean, clearly the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives will be in charge if such a thing happens. So I want them to do the right things when it happens, not the wrong things.
So who's going to win this tug of war between you and John and the government and the people and these private investment banks?
Well, at the moment, the problem is that the political process, we're basically told you can't talk about all of this stuff because we don't like talking about it. So certain things are off limits. like the idea, I mean, we've nationalised the banking system effectively, but people still talk about it as if it was some kind of private sector thing. It isn't. It's a nationalised system now, effectively. But we don't. But what the idea is that as soon as possible we're going to get back to having private banks again. That's a fantasy. That's never going to happen. Eventually, we will construct a public sector banking system to underpin the economy. And many people would call that socialism.
But surely,
I would call it socialism.
But surely the investment banks aren't going to put up with that, are they?
No, they're going to put up a fight. They're putting up a hell of a fight. But the question is this a democratic society or is this a plutocracy? Because at the moment, it looks like a plutocracy, a warmongering plutocracy.
That is a plutocracy ruled by the rich, by the way. Okay, we're on to our next story. And last weekend, the Mail on Sunday had an exclusive interview with police spy or eco-warrior. Make up your own mind. His name's Mark Kennedy. Let's hear what he had to say.
I'm not the only undercover police officer, or I wasn't the only undercover police officer doing this style of work. And I'm quite sure that there may be operations still running. It's a huge mismanagement of staff. Has jeopardised my life and could well jeopardise the lives of other officers in my role as an undercover officer circulating amongst activists. Activists were suspicious of other officers and of other people that may well have been informants. And I reported that fact and I wasn't aware that very much was done about it. Taking an undercover officer out of the activist scene after their deployment had finished, every time it was appalling. You know, the way that I was extracted was totally appalling. I was given no confidence at all that my safety was ever going to be regarded.
Police spy and eco-warrior Mark Kennedy there speaking to the Mail on Sunday. Now, I'll start with you on this one, John. I mean, it does seem that what he's saying there is this mismanagement of these going on within the police and putting lives at risk. And the thing I find so surprising about this, that he's on a salary of £50,000. I'm surprised that he decided that he wanted to go over to the eco-warriors and, I imagine, on the dole or something. Anyway, what are your thoughts about this story?
Well, I find it quite alarming that we've got undercover officers working in what are actually perfectly reasonable protest organisations within this country.
Well, their argument is that they're actually planning these kind of takeovers of power stations, and that's criminal activity.
Yeah, well, I think you know, just having people dealing with things in that way, I find distressing. I think that we have a system which is supposed to be open and transparent, and if we've got our own police force carrying out covert activities, I think there is a difference between police acting covertly and MI5 and MI6, and where you've got the special intelligence forces and so on doing things in counterintelligence, counterterrorism activities. But even there, part of the reason that we're having to do those things is because we're not as open and as straightforward as we need to be.
Martin, isn't the part of the problem here that these ecological activists are being treated almost like terrorists?
Well, one of the things that crosses most people's minds when they hear about how much he's been paid, and in actual fact it costs $1.5 million to keep this guy undercover, is this is a waste of money. Yeah, that's one of the things. There are major concerns also, and I think they've been expressed in parliamentary committees, about provocation on demonstrations. And I'd just like to mention a demonstration I attended in 2008 outside Downing Street when Bush was meeting with Brown, I think it was. There was one individual, and I was there and I saw him, and he was being very problematic. He was shouting, "Kill the pigs, kill the pigs," and he showed people how to break the barriers. He was being very provocative, very nasty, and he was recognised. And somebody said, "I know you, you were at a party on Saturday night, you're a police inspector." And he was photographed and identified. It was Inspector Chris Dreyfus from North London. Chris Dreyfus, that's the name. And a letter of protest was sent from the Stop the War Steering Committee to the Metropolitan Police about this individual, but no action was taken. Now, if we've got a situation where inspectors are fomenting riots, that's incitement to riot, that should certainly be a prison sentence. But
no
disciplinary action is taken at all, then we're moving to a situation like in Belfast in 1969, where people will not trust the police, and then Just imagine, just have a bit of imagination. Can you see a city like Burnley or Bristol where the trust with the police breaks down and communities go to war with each other in the middle of an economic crisis? And if you can't see that, you haven't got any imagination.
Yeah, we've got to be really careful that people do trust the police. And certainly I know that the police locally in Bristol take a huge amount of effort.
By and large, that's absolutely true.
To work with communities, we have the respect agenda. We've had the wonderful film about Isa Ibrahim. I don't know whether you've seen it yet. There's 20-minute film about the Bristol terrorist chap who was going to bomb Cabot Circus, and he's now serving an indeterminate sentence, I think, in prison. But they've done a reconstruction of his situation, and one of the things that came out was that he basically was isolated, and people were ignoring him, and people dismissed him, and people were angry with him because he was asking questions. He was a teenager asking questions.
He used to come to our meetings and sit at the back.
Which meetings were those, Martin?
Stop the War meetings.
Yes.
And he was getting involved in politics, but he went off the rails.
And nobody knew how to do that. So there is now a group of Muslims, four Muslims, who are helping support that, and that will be interesting to talk about another time, perhaps.
And also, it was the Muslim community that dubbed him into the police.
Indeed, it was.
Investigation reveals shocking scale of drink and drugs problem among the young in Bristol. This is the Evening Post on Monday. The majority of alcohol-related attendances at Bristol hospitals involved 14 and 15-year-olds. A toddler whose drink was spiked with Class A drugs, a 5-year-old who had drunk an Alco-Pop, and a baby who overdosed on a substance in its mother's breast milk. These are just some of the children admitted to A&E in Bristol in the last 2 years. Now, this is a pretty shocking report, John.
It is. I mean, I think the harm that's done by alcohol and drugs in the city is huge, and it shouldn't be underestimated. Alcohol, particularly the binge drinking culture that we seem to be developing, we've closed down many of the little family pubs where people could just go along and have a drink, have a quiet drink with their family. And we've replaced them with sort of vertical drinking halls where literally everyone stands up and drinks as much as they can until they fall over. And then we have to have taxi marshals to try and get them into taxis to get them home. And poor taxi drivers have to clear the vomit out of their cabs. So it really is a very unhealthy way of living. And you think, well, why is it? What is it that makes people want to get out of their heads either on drink or drugs? And it is because they're not sure where they're going. They're not sure. They don't have a real sense of direction. We should be thinking about that. It should be ringing alarm bells for all of us across the city. What are we going to do? Why are people drinking like that? Why are we encouraging people to drink like that by licensing lots and lots of cheap bars, cheap things? And there is talk about putting a minimum price onto a unit of alcohol, which will discourage it. And actually, it also means it will encourage drinking in pubs rather than buying bottles from off licenses. So there are things that we can do about it, but certainly the damage to children by drinking is far greater than when you've got a mature liver. There's less problems with it, but even then, drinking more than is recommended or drugging more can be really damaging.
In one case, we're told in the Evening Post, at French Hospital, a baby under the age of one was seen by doctors because it was thought it may have accidentally overdosed on an unknown substance through its mother's breast milk. And in another, a 2-year-old was seen because they'd, in inverted commas, taken some tablets. Martin, well, is there anything we can do about this? Is this just simply we have to throw our hands up in despair?
Well, I think one of the, if there is a major economic crisis, as we've been just talking about, one of the ways people cope with that is by self-medicating with drink and drugs. So there's a real danger that that's going to become a more of a problem. There's no rationality. I mean, alcohol is by far the most dangerous drug, and I speak as somebody who likes a drink. I know the dangers and the damages that it does. Meanwhile, we've got drugs that are illegal with an illegal market, which creates a kind of criminal economy, which is enormous. I mean, the criminal economy for drugs in Bristol is big. There's a lot of money involved
in it. And I suppose it's going to be bigger if, as the economic crisis, people find it difficult to get jobs.
Well, yes, because people can't get jobs, then they find other ways to make money, and selling drugs on the streets in Bristol is a fairly straightforward way to make some money if you're willing to take the risks. There's an NGO based here in Eastern, Transform, which campaigns for the legalisation of drugs. But that sounds like, oh, we're just going to have everybody taking drugs. What we've got to do is have a rational policy about all of this. All of these drugs are bad for you. There should be an absolutely clear about that. There's no justification in my mind for alcohol advertising on the television, for example.
Yeah? I agree.
There should be no. There should be a standard policy for all of these things. You, if you want to smoke tobacco, if you want to drink, if you want to smoke marijuana, wherever, that's okay. We're a liberal society. We let people do it, but we don't encourage it, and we don't advertise it, and we regulate it. Because the problem with the illegal market is it's not regulated at all.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and it's Danny Kushlick who's the elite on the transform agenda. I've spoken to him on a number of occasions, and the thing that really struck me was that there are currently four ways that we allow people to have drugs in Bristol. We can prescribe them as doctors, and we do that with sort of methadone programs and things like that, which is there. We can dispense them from chemists. So there are some drugs which are available over the counter in the chemist. You see the pharmacist and they'll let you have them. We sell some from licensed premises. So things like tobacco and alcohol are examples of that, and we do that. But all other drugs, we don't do any of those three regulated activity. We leave it in the hands of the drug dealers, and we're leaving our children in the hands of the drug dealers, and we're losing millions of pounds in crime. 75-80% of all criminal activity in Bristol is related to drug and alcohol trade. We've got street sex working, which is all related to drugs. Drugs. It is a really big problem, and we need to be talking about it, not as if it's soft on drugs and we're going to make them available, but literally saying they are available. How do we want to regulate their availability? And that is a really adult discussion that we need to be entertaining and raising with the police, with the health services, with the public health teams in Bristol. And I'd be up for that.
Okay, youth unemployment hits record high. I wonder if this is related partly. The total number of adults under 25 who are out of work moved close to the 1 million mark in the 3 months to November, rising by 32,000 up to 951,000. This pushed the youth unemployment rate up to over 20%, which is also the highest level since records began. Martin, do you want to start on this? This is really quite worrying, isn't it? It seems like the young people are bearing the brunt of the recession in joblessness.
Well, that's right, because people who are in work, of course, most companies, private or public, have a situation of first in, last in, first out. And of course, if you're not in, and when the recession hits, then youth unemployment, they bear the brunt of not getting the opportunities. I mean, I was a youngster in the 80s, and I used to live in inner London, and I saw a whole generation of people become basically thrown on the scrap heap. But of course, they don't go quietly onto the scrap heap. These young people are all of military age. And if they don't get useful, sensible things to do, they find something destructive and violent to do. And there's a real danger. If we don't get on top of this, that things can escalate out of control really quickly. I saw both riots in Brixton. They began over virtually nothing, and then within a couple of hours the place was on fire. This can happen very easily.
John, your coalition government has been in power now for something like 8 months, and this seems to be the result. We've got lots of youth unemployment, and the young people are taking.
It was there before, to be fair.
Yes, but this is the highest level ever.
I think it is a major problem, and it is due, as Martin says, to the fact that people who are in jobs are trying to hang on to those jobs, and new people coming onto the jobs market find it difficult. So, for example, in Bristol, on the council, we are taking rigorous steps to try and stick within budget. We're trying to make huge £28 million saving next year, and we could do that by sacking lots of staff. We're trying very hard not to do that, and we're doing what's called vacancy management, so we're not taking on new staff, which means that we've got an ageing workforce, we're not taking on young people in there. We're trying to develop apprenticeships and so on, but they're temporary jobs, they're not long-term jobs. And so we really have to think about how we're going to get young people into work, and the recession and the problems that's caused are disproportionately hitting the young people, and we need to think of ways of addressing that.
Okay, final story. Ed Balls is now Shadow Chancellor. Martin, I'd like to hear what you think as a Labour Party chap. Is Ed Balls going to do the job as Alan Johnson has bowed out now?
Well, when Kerry McCarthy was here a few months ago, we were both surprised that Alan Johnson was appointed to be Shadow Chancellor. We expected either Ed or his wife, Yvette Cooper. In a way, I think it's good that during the leadership election campaign, Ed Balls was talking about building a whole new generation of council houses. In other words, what I want to see from the Labour leadership as we go into this crisis is we've got to start we've got to start getting a distinctive socialist voice on the crisis. We don't believe, I don't believe, that there should be any cuts in public expenditure. That sounds extreme, but very soon people are going to realise it's just common sense.
Well, one thing I will say about Ed Balls is since 2006, he's been one of these people that goes along to these Bilderberg conferences, these secret conferences of the rich and powerful, that he's not allowed to say anything about what's happened in there. And that means, of course, that both the opposition shadow chancellor and the Chancellor George Osborne are both people who go along to these secret conferences. I mean, surely what's happening is actually the financial elite who control these conferences are really now controlling both sides of the chessboard economically, and Ed Balls is probably the worst person to have in that job.
Well, I mean, basically whoever was the shadow chancellor would probably end up at Bilderberg, whoever it was, because that's the nature of the game. I mean, if you're playing at that level, you tend to be invited to these kind of meetings.
But where do his loyalties lie if he's prepared to keep secret about what happens at these conferences?
That's a very good question. I think there's been far too much neoliberal attitudes in the Labour Party for many years, and so the many things that the last Labour government did were wrong.
Well, thanks very much, Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Health and Inequalities, Ashley Ward Councillor John Rogers. Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.